Good evening, everyone. Welcome. I want to acknowledge our sponsor, Gazette Newspapers, that makes it possible for us to have this lecture series. And tonight we're going to hear from Professor James Sampirico. Jim is a professor of environmental science and policy at UC Davis, and he's also a non-resident fellow at the Resources for the Future in Washington, D.C., which is a nonprofit environmental think tank. He received his PhD in agricultural and resource economics from UC Davis, and he grew up in northern New Jersey, got his bachelor's degree from Boston University in economics and math, went to work for the Resources for the Future for a number of years, and then was recruited to UC Davis. His main research interests include the economic analysis of policy design and implementation for marine and terrestrial species conservation, the development of economic ecological models for forecasting the effects of resource management policies on the economics and ecology, and the control and prevention of invasive species. He has served on lots of very important boards. Right now he's on NOAA Science Advisory Board. He's also a member of the Science and Technical Panel Expert Committee, the UN Global Environmental Facility. He's been on editorial councils at the Journal of Environmental Economics and Management, Ecology Letters, the Journal of Agricultural and Resource Economics, and he recently served on the National Research Council's Committee to Review the U.S. Ocean Research Priorities Plan. He's an unusual guy because he's a social scientist. And one of the things that we have come to realize in dealing with these big ocean issues is that we need lots more social scientists, and people especially like Jim. And so it's great to have Jim with us tonight. He was here this afternoon. He saw the aquarium. His daughter is in the back somewhere. She hasn't decided whether she's going to stay and hear Dad or go look at some more fish. But anyway, it's good to have Anna here. Please welcome Jim.
Thank you very much. It was an honor to be invited to come down here to give this talk, and it's been a pleasure. We've had a great day going around the aquarium. It's a wonderful place. There's been some differences in advertisement with respect to the title of the talk. I will actually cover all the material that was described with the other title. I'm just going to go about it in a slightly different way, and that is sort of build up to it, and so doing, give you some sense of how ocean zoning, how I'm perceiving it, fits into the broader perspective and trends in ocean management around ecosystem-based principles, around coastal marine spatial planning, and then where does ocean zoning sort of fit in with that picture? And this schematic will come back multiple times in the talk to sort of talk about how these pieces sort of fit together. And as I said, what I'll start with is sort of at the top. And what does it mean when we think about ecosystem-based management principles? And how do we think about taking that into a management kind of context? Because those principles will basically overlay everything that we're going to be talking about when we think about marine spatial planning, and then when I actually talk about this idea of ocean zoning, which I see as the implementation of the plan itself. So there's a scientific consensus statement that came out, I think it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, where they laid out how we think about defining ecosystem-based management. There are many definitions out there, but they're all about the same in terms of covering this material. So what does it actually mean to think about these principles and this kind of management? Well, we want to emphasize protection of the ecosystem structure, the functioning, the key processes. It's place-based. That is, we understand that there's differences that we need to take into account when we're thinking about marine and coastal policy across, especially the U.S. and also in the world. It accounts for interconnections within species, whether that comes through a food web, whether it comes through market interactions, but the idea that things, you can't just manage things in isolation. And this all came out of this whole idea of ecosystem-based management is really in response to looking around, seeing how we've typically gone about managing in the oceans and coasts as single sector focus, single species, single sector. And they, this whole idea was, well, wait a second, we know these things are interacting, and so maybe we need to think about that when we're setting policy. It integrates not just the ecology, but the social sciences, institutional perspectives, and finally considers the cumulative impacts of different sectors. Context, like I said, for ecosystem-based management and the idea of pushing this forward as a way to change how we currently do things is really trying to just address four key challenges. And there's others, and we could parse some of these words, but these are sort of the main challenges we face when we think about regulating ocean uses. So first of all, as everyone knows here, the oceans are not inexhaustible. They are renewable resources, but we can actually use them to the points where they aren't renewable anymore. So we can use them, overuse leads to sort of long-term resource loss. That's not surprising in this audience, I'm sure. Also, the idea that the use of one resource can affect the costs and benefits of utilizing other resources. This is this idea of the interconnections. If you're making decisions with respect to a prey species, that's going to affect what you can do for that particular predator. That's the obvious one that people often talk about. But it could also be that it doesn't have to be in the ecology of these interactions. It could be in the uses. It could be that you make decisions about how much a commercial fishery can catch. That's going to impact the costs and benefits of the recreational fishing sector, who could be harvesting for that same species. So these interconnections and this idea of the spillover aren't just, I want to emphasize, not just in the ecology. Usually more than one user group is interested in each resource or space. The example I just gave of the commercial and recreational fishing one is the one that's often put forth. And then there's lots of uncertainties on these cumulative impacts and also the value of resources to various user groups. All these things make it difficult to think about how to manage ocean uses. And as I said, ecosystem-based management is one principle that's come out to try to address some of these. But I also think this also fits nicely in, as we'll get to, why we're going down this road of thinking about coastal and marine spatial planning and then further into this idea of implementing with ocean zoning. So when we talk about traditional uses, and I just realized I should probably cancel one given the bill that was just put forth by some senators on the West Coast. We should probably get rid of oil and gas exploration development if we're going to believe that's going to go forward. But here's, you know, the sample of the sort of traditional uses that we throw up with regards to the oceans. We talk about aquaculture, commerce, and transportation. That's one that surprisingly, I mean, not here in the Port of Long Beach, that you'd think that it'd be left off the table. But a lot of times that is left off the table for some reason. We just don't, maybe we don't think about it as much. Commercial fishing, mining, sand and gravel. A lot of the sand is being used, for example, in beach nourishment projects. And you could imagine that with increased storm frequency, storm surges, that the need to nourish beaches will increase, which will increase the demand for sand and the mining of sand. This is especially important off New England. Recreational fishing, renewable energy, environmental conservation. I'm one who puts conservation as a use, but that is not always thought of that way. Some believe that it sort of is above the idea of a use. But the way I'll think about it is a use. Marine sanctuaries, reserves, parks, there's archaeology, and of course other recreation, which here down in Southern California is a dominant. And then not to leave off scientific research and exploration. So lots of uses that we think about currently ongoing. And then you see these maps where they map all these uses. This was came out of a paper that was in Science in August 2006. This is right off your shore. I thought it was fitting. And the point here is to look at this map and go, wow. There's a lot of stuff going on. It looks like it could all be conflicting, and it looks pretty ad hoc, right? That's the kind of conclusion that you want to think about, right? And you've got all these different uses from aquaculture ports, different state marine reserves, and they're all basically mapped. But the idea is that there's this potential conflicting uses, and we need to think about how do we sort of allocate these across space. Now, I am from northern New Jersey, and we have the same problem in on the East Coast, right? This is a map that was done from the Department of Interior Minerals Management Service. I guess maybe I should block that. They're not in good standing right now. But they've had a marine cadastry program for a long time, trying to do exactly what the science article did. They're just mapping different uses. And so you can look at the same maps and look at there are potential conflicting, and these spaces are being used for multiple uses at one time. And so the challenges, the idea of ecosystem-based, moving off of the single species, single sector, the idea that we're looking at all these traditional uses, and then this idea that these uses coming online that are going to just increase the demand for a particular place, such as wind energy, coastal energy, aquaculture, has led many to sort of talk about, well, we need to actually think about this in sort of ex ante. We need to develop plans. And that's really sort of been the momentum building behind coastal and marine spatial planning. And what I'm going to do now is I'm just going to sort of give you some sense of what are the current efforts, what is coastal marine spatial planning, how does the federal government talk about it, what is the federal government doing with respect to this, and then also highlight some efforts that are going on in states to give you some sense of what's happening. So there was a memorandum that President Obama signed June 12, 2009 that established an interagency ocean policy task force. The task force basically was to develop recommendations for a national ocean policy, a framework for improved stewardship, and coastal and marine spatial planning. So thinking about how we're going to do this at a federal level. Ecosystem-based principles were at the core of this memorandum, right? The idea that we need to think about this as a holistic system. Defined, so I'll use a couple of the definitions and how they describe coastal marine spatial planning from the interim report. So this language really just comes directly from them. They did the memorandum in June 12th. They had two reports. The marine spatial planning one was released on December 14th. In that report, they talk about this marine spatial planning as a public process of allocating the spatial and temporal distribution of human activities to achieve economic, ecological, social objectives. So I highlighted things here that I'm going to come back to. This idea of a public process, this idea that marine spatial planning is an allocation process, and we really need to think about what that actually means, that it's very important, and this the spatial and temporal. So according to the interim report, it is comprehensive. This is what they say marine spatial planning is. It's adaptive, it's integrated, it's ecosystem-based, it's transparent, and it's based on sound science. Those are all very laudable characteristics. The question that you have if you look at this interim report is that there is few details on how we're actually going to do this. There's the idea of what it is, and here's what it should be in the ideal. And for many reasons you'd expect in this kind of report, they wouldn't get into the details. But what I'm going to try to do later on the talk is how can we make and implement marine spatial planning to actually be some of those characteristics, or hopefully most of them. It identifies, this is from the report, it identifies areas most suitable for various types or classes of activities in order to reduce conflicts, reduce environmental impacts, and facilitate compatible uses. This is where, if you looked at the report, there is some differences in the language. So here it is. Now marine spatial planning is only identifying, right? It's a very different perspective of actually trying to do something and implementing it. It's just we're going to identify the areas. And so there's some tension still at the federal level about what it is and how this is going to work. But there is one thing that's very clear about it, and that is that it's going to be a regional focus. And those regions have been determined. They are basically highlighted here on the maps. So there's a couple of lines here. We are here on the West Coast. This would be the West Coast planning region. This blue line is a large marine ecosystem delineation for basically the California Current. There's a couple large marine ecosystems in Alaska, but this is one region for planning, the Pacific Islands, the Gulf of Mexico, South Atlantic, Mid-Atlantic, and Northeast. It's very similar and follows the delineation on the Fishery Management Councils, where the commercial fishery management is being developed for these areas. But this is, so it is a regional focus, and some of these regional planning boards, which are going to be now taking this report and trying to think about how to do this plan, are actually already ongoing. And so it has momentum. They argue in the report, why is it needed? They say it's because there's this increase in user conflicts, this inefficiencies with the associated costs and delays in the current regulatory and planning. They're looking at the same data that I just showed you in terms of the maps of uses, and then the potential loss from this ad hoc process of just doing this as things come up over time, the potential loss of that in terms of the ecosystem functions and services, both from an economic and ecological and also cultural perspective. And so this is how they're justifying the need to go forward with marine spatial planning. They talk about a list of benefits. It's this new approach about how we're going to use these resources differently. It moves us away from sector by sector, statute by statute decision making. Again, the details aren't here yet, right? But this is the idea. We're going to create this unprecedented cooperation. Science is going to be used at the heart of decision making, and it's going to be stakeholder and public participation. A great, really laudable goals. This is what we would expect. And hopefully what we'll talk to or get to at the end is how do we think about developing this, these conditions that will make that occur. Examples of state-level efforts going on. Massachusetts just released their plan. It was essentially focused on wind energy and left the other uses off the table. So here's just to give you a sense of the Massachusetts plan that came out. So this is the Massachusetts state waters. Is this hatched area. Everything that's hatched is what was left as multiple use. That's basically everything that's ongoing currently. And what they did do, though, is they delineated two wind energy areas. But those are areas where they're going to allow permits to potentially go forward with respect to wind energy. The kind of data they used to do this analysis, well, this bottom one, you can't read it, but all you have to know is that these green circles are historical levels of recreational fishing that was occurring. And so those were areas where there was lots of recreational activities going on. I thought this was just interesting from its artistic point of view. These are vessel tracks from VMS, vessel monitoring systems. And so they were tracking vessels. If you're focusing on wind energy, one of the issues was that you didn't want to necessarily put it in an area where there's going to be lots of vessel traffic. And so that was a consideration. And there's lots of things. They not only did this for recreational uses. Well, that's another story. They did this for commercial fishing. I mean, number of uses. But this just gives you some idea of the data that was used and the map. They also said there's a couple areas here in black. These are provisional areas for potentially future development. And then these are sort of areas where it's completely prohibited in the future. So Rhode Island is currently developing a plan, a map similar to Massachusetts. It was really motivated, again, by wind energy, but from what I understand from people who are involved in the process, it's more encompassing than what Massachusetts did. That is, that it's not just going to be wind energy and everything else. They're actually going to do wind energy, and some other uses will be delineated at the same time. Washington State just signed into law on March 19th a new law on marine spatial planning, which is being called the most comprehensive state-level effort to date. They haven't started the process, but they have the legislation in place. So other examples of ongoing efforts, well, the Great Barrier Reef in Australia is really held up as the role model for how to think about zoning and ocean and marine spatial planning. It was first zoned, and they used that term in Australia, in 1976, and then was just rezoned in 2004. The Belgian portion of the North Sea has gone forward with a marine spatial plan. And then this has been going on in the sanctuaries, that they've actually already been thinking about zoning and allocating by uses. And the example here is the Florida National Marine Sanctuary, where they have zones for for existing management areas, wildlife management, ecological reserves, sanctuary preservation areas, and other special use areas. So even within the sanctuaries, they've already thought about this and actually are up front in this process. Okay, I have to talk about California a little bit, just a little. Where does California Marine Life Protection Act fit in? Well, essentially, you can think of it as just it's a gradation of efforts ongoing. And if Massachusetts focused on wind energy, California's really taken the perspective of focusing on the conservation areas and setting aside those first, right? Massachusetts could come back and do conservation, and California could come back and do wind energy, but it was just which aspect of the decisions did you want to focus on first? And that's really what MLPA has been. Now, there is, you know, there's a state marine reserve, which is pretty much off limits, and then these marine parks and conservation areas do allow some potentially extractive uses if you've got permits for those. But in some sense, you know, so you could think of it as focusing on the conservation first, but it does omit some of the other processes. And this is just happens to be the central California coast. I did that on purpose, not putting up any proposed map for the south coast. Okay. So this has just been a really quite long introduction about trying to now motivate this idea of implementation and thinking about where does this idea of ocean zoning sort of fit in. We've got this ecosystem-based management principles. We have this momentum right now to do the coastal marine spatial plans. It's both at the state and the federal level. But the question's going to be is, what happens when we go to the implementation? And how can we think about that implementation? And coming from a social science perspective, think about it in a way that it generates conditions that give us all those great things that we talk about it now. You know, how do we get there from here? So there's many ideas on what this ocean zoning is. There's been articles written on it for many years. Some sort of have this idea of more of a top-down regulatory mechanism. The idea that we're going to plan and then we're going to just allocate uses and that's it. We're going to put everybody in this and it's going to be a pretty rigid process, sort of top-down sort of focus. Some, on the other hand, think of this as a way of privatizing the ocean, that let's just devolve rights and decentralize the management. And we'll do this through the umbrella of an ocean zoning sort of regime. And that both of these arguments you can find out there. I'm going to argue that it's going to fall in between. I'm going to say if we have too much fragmentation and top-down prescriptions are going to dissipate all these gains that I think we can get out of this system when we think about the incentives that it provides users. And so, you know, if you got this, if it's too much top-down, you already know the arguments. They're going to be, you know, the industries already feel like they're overburdened with regulations currently, especially after, in some in California, after going through the MLPA process. We'll have this sense, right? So we want to figure out how we can come up with a system that will be attractive to them. But we also want to make sure that we're not setting up a system that doesn't have necessarily oversight. I'm an economist, and I've actually had this slide for many years, but it really rings home, of course, after the markets collapsed, right? And one of the arguments being that we sort of fell asleep at the wheel in terms of regulating the market. I would be one who would say, you know, we can't just decentralize without oversight in this system. And so we have to be careful that those who want to just privatize the ocean, that we'll actually be devolving too much of this, and we want to make sure we have oversight. So I'm going to, before I get into the details, give you some sense of what I think some of the benefits from this ocean zoning or this proposal I'm going to make. One of them is this idea that we're going to create opportunities to form both formal and informal institutions in the oceans that currently don't exist, that are going to enable us to think about coordinating activities and maximizing long-term resource yields. And hopefully, by the end of the talk, I at least have provided some information about why I think that'll occur. You're going to develop a constituency for ocean health. We're going to create more certainty for users. That is, we'll have some sense of where these activities are going to be permitted, and then they'll have access to those areas. for those activities. And we'll also think about that we're going to expand the set of tools that we have available to address conflicts in the marine environment. So the way to think about this is that on land, we really have three systems available if there's a conflict that comes up. We can do regulations, including planning. Planning is just another form of a regulation, right, to limit a particular activity if it's creating conflict. We can go through the courts, there's a judicial resolution, and there's private ordering. Individuals can get together and contract, negotiate with themselves to deal with the particular issues. In the marine context, though, we're mainly focused on regulation. There's some judicial for large cases, but mainly all of these conflicts are being resolved through the regulatory process. And I'm going to argue through the thing that that's actually a pretty inefficient way of thinking about it, of setting up a system, especially when we have a system that's going to be dealing with issues of climate change. So to achieve those benefits, there's a set of conditions that have to be met. One is sort of clearly defined boundaries, place-based rules, collective choice, the right to organize, this idea of conflict resolution, and nested enterprises. And basically, the bold ones are almost by default, you get somewhere along that continuum to that, right? Clearly defined boundaries, well, that's process of a plan and the zoning implementation of that. Place-based rules, well, that's the whole idea that you'll have rules that are tailored to particular locations. And if you're doing the zoning correctly, the potential for conflict resolution. That's one of the motivators for zoning in the first place. And so potentially some of these will just come out. The question, though, is how do we get the other ones? How do we build a system where we have collective choice, the right to organize at different levels, and these nested enterprises? And not only how do we get those, but how do we make sure that the other ones are being addressed enough to change? So one question you might have is where do these conditions come from? Well, these are the conditions that Eleanor Ostrom, who just won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2009, identified by looking around the world at situations where the commons was being managed sustainably. And she found that when these conditions were being met, the commons were being managed without needing government intervention. Right? So these conditions don't come from anywhere. They come from thinking about what leads to successful management of the commons. And as I noticed in one of these great exhibits today, they're talking about commons and the oceans and the tragedy of the commons. So we're all educated in thinking about ocean resources in such a system. Okay, so this is the idea is, how do we think about zoning as a means to enable these conditions, which then more likely get us to successful management? Okay, so what is my policy proposal? Well, you still have the comprehensive marine spatial plan. The zoning is really on the implementation side. And the necessary components I'm going to argue we need are this dominant use designation for each zone, and I'll define that in a second. I think we need to think about these zones with quality standards across the ecology for each zone. And I used these words on purpose because I want the analogy to the Clean Water Act and the water quality standards to come out. I think as we have in the Clean Water Act, we set a set of beneficial uses, and then we set the water quality standards to meet those uses. We could think of dominant uses as a way of setting those uses, and then there's a set of standards that have to be met to be able to maintain that use in a particular zone. We're just not going to let it go. There has to be a standard. And then within the dominant use classification, there's a development of user rights within each zone. And then I think we have to set the system up that it's flexible, durable, and also accountable. And the accountable ties into the idea of the standards. Okay, so here's my schematic again. But now I'm going to break apart this idea of the zoning and put things into tiers or phases that I think have to occur. So, tier one here is where you have the simultaneously assessment of what the dominant uses will be in a particular zone and the standards that have to be met. That is an allocation process, right? The classic turning into allowing certain uses to be in certain places. And then tier two is the second set of allocation. That is, once you determine those dominant uses, there's the development of user rights within the dominant use. And I'll explain how this will work or how I think it might work. So the outline for the remainder of the talk, I can't see it, it's half past, is that right? Okay, great. So I'll talk about dominant use, I'll go into this user rights, and then the sort of the ending part of this, we'll take a step back and say, as we're doing this process, there's potential opportunities to rethink ocean governance. I don't have an answer, I'm just more going to propose different types of models we might think about as we move forward, and then some sort of concluding thoughts, which really just addresses some questions that commonly come up and potential answers for. So dominant use zone, what is it? Well, the way to sort of frame it is there's an exclusive use zone where you give a single use exclusive right to undertake activities. Dominant use is similar, except that now we're going to allow the potential for variances and special exemptions. So an example of a dominant use zone that currently on land is the National Wildlife Refuge areas. And the idea here is if I want to do an activity in a dominant use and I'm not part of that use, I can apply for a variance or special exemption. And now the burden of proof is on to me to say that I'm not going to affect the priority use that's ongoing in that area. Okay? So I have to show that I will not adversely impact the ability to take that use and, accordingly, the attainment of those standards. So what does dominant use designation do? And this is like zoning 101. So zoning, what it does, we think about, is it separates out incompatible uses, right? You think about on land, it was the movement of taking out industry and residential houses and separating them, right, to try to minimize the damage associated with pollution, for example. So you're separating out injured and the injured parties as a means to reduce the damages. And this kind of activity performs much better for small-scale sort of conflicts, place-based. You wouldn't necessarily, for example, I mean, you could, but it's not necessarily the way I would go, think about zoning as a solution for carbon emissions, right? That's a large-scale problem. The emissions are mixed completely in the atmosphere. Zoning any particular region is not necessarily the solution. Zoning works much better when you can contain and find the mitigate those damages by separating out those activities. If there's spillover, then there's a potential problem. And the example I would use in my class is, so we had restaurants where we had smokers and non-smokers mixed, right? And then the idea was, well, we had issues with the smoke affecting the non-smokers, secondhand smoke. So the idea was we zoned restaurants where we had smoking sections and non-smoking sections. But then we realized that the wait staff actually walks between those areas, and they were still getting the secondhand smoke. And so what we do, we actually then decided that we didn't want smokers and non-smokers in the same building. But that's an example, for example, of this idea of zoning as a tool that we've all seen, and where, you know, it didn't necessarily work that well because smoke traveled. Even if you did have smoking and non-smoking sections, you had tables at the boundary, and smoke didn't know necessarily that it wasn't supposed to cross that boundary. Right? That's an example of spillover with still not being contained by the original idea of separating out the two parties. The piece of zoning, though, that gets lost, I think, in the discussion is actually, I think, some of the most powerful in terms of the ocean setting. And that is that it not only separates, but it rations. So it rations the area over which activities can occur. So go back to the restaurant. When you separated out the smokers and the non-smokers, you were determining how many tables each had. You were rationing the access to that restaurant for smokers and non-smokers, right? And that's actually a pretty important thing when we're going to get back to understanding how this can change the incentives of the users involved in this process. And so what I want to do is highlight this idea of what rationing can do, especially in a system where we have very little rights. Right, we're conflicting uses for use rights that very little idea of a very incomplete set of rights currently exist in the oceans. That's why we call it sort of the commons. So what does rationing do? Well, it improves the set of rights to places. That is, it allows you to say smokers have here and non-smokers, and it improves the clarity on who has the access rights. So in an ocean setting where those two things are missing, the idea of the zones and then the rationing associated with it, is going to create conditions. And I argue that you putting separating and rationing together, you're going to develop in the ocean realm sort of a set of localized goods and services whose users are limited, they're better defined, and depending on how well the separating did, potential conflicts have been reduced. Okay, so the idea is you're taking a system where everybody didn't have much guarantee about where different activities were occurring, and you're now restructuring it and saying, no, we're going to allow a certain amount of users in this particular area. The size of the area is what's also going to help dominate how many people can potentially, or how many different uses can potentially use it. And more powerfully, it creates this idea of group rights. Particular groups that have now a dominant use allocation, have the area set aside, potentially now have also this idea they have rights, potential rights over that particular area. So what are some of the ancillary benefits that we talk about in sort of economics when you improve the rights over these resources? Well, you could, for example, think about group rights setting in the motion this idea of place-based clubs. We see clubs form for many reasons. It could be just the taste of associating with each other, potential economies of scale or scope, sharing of information, more tangible goods. So one example that's been talked about, or one of the things in the oceans that is very difficult and coming down here in Southern California is very evident, is the idea of how to think about recreational fishing. From a regulatory perspective, it's a very hard thing to deal with. There's lots of diffuse users, very heterogeneous group, really hard to monitor activities. So it's a very difficult thing to get your handle on. Well, one idea out there was this idea, well, you could create or think of creating in certain areas recreational fishing clubs. And then you'd allocate a catch to the club, and the club then would think about through its membership how it was going to allocate the catch amongst its members. Similar to hunting clubs, right? Not every area would have to have a recreational fishing club, but that was an idea. So when people propose this idea, they've sort of left it on the table about how that actually might come about. How would we develop this club? We have a set of diffuse users. One argument for this idea of group rights is that changes the incentives. You allocate potentially an area for recreational fishing. That could be the catalyst from which a club then will form. It makes sense for those individuals in that area to come together to collectively think about what the impacts are in that area. They have a stake in the future because this area has been designated for them. They have to meet certain standards, and there's incentives in place for them to actually think about forming this club. A lot of those conditions about why we might see them occur sort of develop. You could think of this as this idea of dominant use is not has to be for any particular use, but maybe it's a commercial activity zone. And what we see in certain places, you have business improvement districts, businesses getting together to finance improvements in the local downtowns. Why do they do that? Because there's a return to it, right? It creates a better climate for more business in the future. You can think about those kind of ideas coming out. Also, if you were going to think about these clubs, the value of being part of the club is going to be a function of the health of the environment. I wouldn't want to be part of a recreational fishing club if I wasn't going to catch a fish. Just like I wouldn't be part of a hunting club if I wasn't going to be guaranteed I was going to be able to shoot an animal. Same idea here. You degenerate the idea of these clubs. Well, the clubs themselves now are tied to maintaining a healthy environment. We're creating incentives that fall in line with improving stewardship of the environment. So you could think about flexibility and adaptability in such a system where dominant uses introduces this idea of potential trading or contracting across zones. So let's say you had a zone that was for conservation, and that conservation zone decided that it wanted to reduce some fishing in the recreational fishing area. And they say, you know what, we'll allow some access into our area if you guys will reduce the amount of fishing that is ongoing. And you can begin to see, if you've got those dominant uses set aside, and that you can begin to create a climate where this kind of negotiation and contracting can be put in place. Now, in this case, if the fishing industry, for example, wanted to go into the conservation zone, they would have to show that they're not having an impact on the conservation zone meeting its and being able to meet its standards and attainment of its goals. In this case, the burden of the proof would be on the group trying to come in, get that variance or permit. Now, of course, I could do the roles that are completely reversed in terms of the burden of the proof. But what we see, if you look at the California Marine Life Protection Act, and I'm not going to make any judgment on this, but there is a feeling out there, especially in the conservation community, that they have to prove in the conservation community that these marine life protected areas are not going to have an impact on the fishing sector, whether it be commercial or recreation. The burden of the proof for them is on them in their mind, coming into this system, right? That I can see that. We can argue it. I'm not going to say either way, but what this system does, though, is begin to change the different power in the political process of different interests. The idea of these variances and special permits introduce flexibility and adaptability. You could see nested enterprises. This actual image has come out of the Rhode Island spatial management plan, where they've got a wind farm, and this is shellfish aquaculture going on, where you're jointly thinking about an enterprise together. Right? It makes perfect sense to think that, well, maybe I should change my, let's say make this renewable energy. At one point, I was thinking that oil and gas platforms made a nice management for offshore aquaculture, but let's throw that out for a while. But you could also see renewable energy and the idea of jointly coming together using this particular space. Now, you could allocate this to wind energy, and wind energy can then go and contract with aquaculture operations to do this. We don't need necessarily have to think about the government determining where all of these potential possibilities are. And as I said, the better sort of accountability for damages. So the idea you have to, one thing you have to ask is, why don't we see this now? Why don't we see these coalitions, agreements going on? And the major reason is this idea that we don't have very good defined rights and responsibilities in the ocean. And that's different than on land, right? On land, we do have very good property rights and property rights systems. So we know what our particular rights are, and we know what the value is in the future of doing different activities. When you don't have very well-defined rights, you're into a world where it's not quite clear what I do today, whether or not I'm going to get the gains out in the future, right? And so if I was going to go into a long-term agreement with someone, well, the barriers for that, when I don't know if I'm going to have the access to do that myself in the future, are pretty high, right? So we don't see these things because there's all these barriers out there. So it generates sort of significant transaction costs. And the idea here is that zoning, the dominant use and the ability to have permits and variances will lower some of these barriers that currently exist, creates better defined access rights and who has those rights, and sort of create more vehicles to address sort of conflicts. So how do we think about this tier one allocation process? You don't have to think about designated an area for every possible use of the ocean. You don't have to do that if you have this idea of flexibility. You don't have to think about matching the ecosystem scale necessarily with the scale of the zones or the governance. This is a big issue in thinking about, you know, what was the right regional focus for the federal government, right? They stayed at the level of sort of the large marine ecosystem. But if you allow this flexibility and adaptability over time, that need doesn't necessarily exist, especially if you're setting ecological quality standards to take that into account. How could you do allocation? Well, allocation is going to be messy. It could be based on historical use patterns, which is sort of what the default's been in the state processes currently, and is probably what the default's going to be in the federal process. You're going to have maps out there that map historical use. We're going to try to find points of minimum overlap. But it doesn't have to be that way. I have to keep my economics carrying card. I'll lose it if I don't say you could do things like auction them off like we do the spectrum, right? We can think about auctioning off rights. I think it's very important to think about and not forget the idea of pairing the allocation with the development of those standards. Okay, so that was tier one. Tier two is this idea of, okay, we've got the dominant use, we've got the standards, now we need to think about within a dominant use zone the rights that currently exist. And so this is sort of the tier two allocation. Dominant use is great, but it's only a sufficient condition for sort of achieving the goal. Rights are better defined, but they're still incomplete. And the example I throw up here is the exclusive economic zone. That's the area in yellow here, where the U.S., in a means of trying to keep out foreign commercial vessels from fishing in our waters, also for seabed minerals and oil, we declared a 200-mile exclusive economic zone. And in one way, that's probably the largest experiment of zoning that we've seen on a global scale, right? It was an idea that you were creating zones. But what they did not do, and why we still have displays here at the Long Beach Aquarium talking about overfishing and dealing with all these other conflicts, is we didn't deal with the rights well after we did this initial declaration. So we have to think about this idea of, well, how do we then, after we classify a dominant use, we can't just walk away. What are we going to do with respect to the uses, the users within that use classification? And I just want to put up, not all dominant uses necessarily need this second tier. It depends on the use. You could argue that once you've designated a conservation zone, that didn't necessarily need any further activity afterwards. But for a lot of the ones that have commercial activities, you can think about it as being important. So how might you think about this allocation? Well, it could be in terms of long-term leases, concessions that are consistent with the classification. Within fishing, commercial fishing, and sort of charter boat recreational fishing, you could think about allocating rights and privileges to individuals for shares of the resource in that area. That falls under a term that's been used a lot recently, catch shares. These programs include things, what's called individual fishing quota systems. So those who don't know what that is, that's a cap and trade policy. And what that means is you set a cap, the total allowable catch, and then you allocate that to individual fishermen, a share of that catch. Okay, and that is opposed to this idea that you're just having the fishermen compete against each other to catch as much as possible. Here you're actually allocating individual shares of that to the individual fishermen. This is also consistent with current federal efforts to expand the use of these catch share programs. Dr. Jane Lubchenco, who's the administrator for NOAA, has made catch share programs in the implementation one of her areas to focus on, and that is both in the commercial and charter boat. Again, this idea of pairing rights with responsibilities. We don't typically think about that, but I think we, at the time of allocation, we need to make sure that they understand that it's based on whether or not they're going to meet the standards within that area. So I just have up some examples of some of the gains that you achieve when you think about adding these catch share programs into fisheries. And so here are just some of the statal benefits and some empirical findings. So many of these fisheries, they operate under what is known as derby fisheries. Basically, the government will say, let's say you can catch 100 metric tons of a particular species, and then the fishermen enter into a race, basically, catch as much as possible. If you watch The Deadliest Catch, for the early parts of that, in the early seasons, that was all a derby fishery, right? The crab fishery was all being caught in a race. And then what they do, they actually instituted a catch share program where they didn't have to race anymore. They all had their allocations. But that's the example. So what we see is that once you do that, you reduce the incentive to race for fish, and the fishing season length goes from 10 days, this is British Columbia halibut, 10 days the year before it was implemented to 260 days the year after. And there's lots of advantages to slowing down fishing. There's a reduction in ghost fishing, that is a lost gear. There's advantages from no longer am I thinking about maximizing the quantity of a particular, how much I get, but now I'm thinking about maximizing the quality. And that has beneficial implications. Here's an example I've studied in detail, the New Zealand system. The red snapper fishery, that was basically a frozen product trawl fishery before the program went from trawl to longline to pots, because what they were doing was is they were working up the value chain. And eventually they were supplying live fish into the Japanese market. That has since gone away, by the way, with the recession. The live fish market sort of collapsed. But it was the idea that that's where their incentives were, no longer on maximizing the quantity, but maximizing the value of the system. And there were ecological gains. Trawl fisheries are some of the most bycatch intensive gears out there, right? Long line's a little bit better. Pot fisheries are pretty minimal in terms of bycatch. So this walking up the economic value chain actually also resulted in ecological improvements. There's a reduction in the number of fishing vessels. Here's a cooperative, so this is not an individual fishing quota. This is giving a set of boats who would form a cooperative allocation and letting them just determine how to do it amongst themselves. Here's Alaskan pollock. The first year that it was implemented, there were 20 vessels in the cooperative, but they got together and said, you know what, we should retire 4 for the year. We're only going to fish 16. They determined that because that made sense on the economics, but it also reduced the amount of capacity out there, which is one of the important driving factors behind overfishing. The idea that improved the ability to manage their business operations. BC halibut fishermen call into fish processors before they go out to find out what the price of fish is. Now, when you had a derby fishery, the season would open and you'd have to catch it. And it didn't matter that when you got to dock, everybody else brought their catch and the price was really low. That's what you had. Because if you waited for that price to be higher, you likely would have missed out because there'd be no more fish left under the TAC. Everyone else would have caught it. You couldn't plan ahead, right? But what we see is as we define these rights better, they're doing things that are not only make sense from an economic point of view, but are actually improving the ecology. And this is the idea that you create this dominant use, you create an idea of group rights, and then within that we can think about devolving some of those rights at a lower level in the system. So what are some of the lessons learned from these catch share programs? Development of an ownership ethic, the reinforcement of stewardship incentives. That is, the return from being a better steward has private and not just social returns. That is that if I decided, you know, if I was operating in a derby fishery and I just said, you know what, this year I'm not going to catch as much as I did last year because I want more fish there and I know that the levels are quite low, there'd be no return to that because I have no guarantee that any action I was doing, I was going to see the benefit of it. So there was a social return because I felt like I was doing the right thing maybe, but there's no private return. But now with a better defined right, I know that I can see the benefits because I'm going to have a right to catch a certain amount of fish and I can see that that might make it lower cost for me to fish, for example, if there's greater population levels. So I have an incentive to maintain the system at a higher level in terms of its ecology. We saw investments in catching differences in processing. So that is, the numbers are going to escape me, but in the whiting fishery off the West Coast, this is mainly Oregon, they saw a product recovery rate. So that is, you know, you catch the fish and then you process it into many different forms. 5 minutes? Okay. They saw a product recovery rate of, I think it was about 35%, which it was equivalent of catching, I don't know the numbers, but basically catching on the order of about 10% more fish. Just because they slowed the process down of fishing, they had more time to process it, more time to invest in value added. We saw increased profitability, stable fish stocks, and the last one is we learned from this that an allocation process is incredibly difficult and sticky because everybody wants to make sure that they're getting the most at the allocation. And so what you also learn, though, is in places like New Zealand, in that initial allocation process, they forget about it. 3 or 4 years into the system, that's gone. No one's talking about it. Everybody's talking about how great the new system is. And so that's a lesson to be thought about when we think about things like MLPA or ocean zoning or marine planning, where the allocation seems to be and is quite tricky. Okay, so that was sort of putting the pieces together, and I'm going to go through, there's actually not much here, so I can go through this relatively quickly. But it was this idea of rethinking ocean governance if you're going to go down this path. Do we want to stay under the current system or not? And there's a couple different models. We could think about, and this has been proposed, an Uber agency, Uber Ocean Agency, that now would manage all these uses, right? So it would have administrative responsibility for all zones in a region. You could think of coordinated agencies, that is, you maintain the current structure, but with coordination activities with and across zones, or specialized zone agencies. We could think about this like we do on land, like there's the Park Service, there's Wildlife Refuge, BLM, Bureau of Land Management, they manage their own lands. We could think about specialized agencies, which each one manage particular types of zones. These are all different ideas about how to think about the governance structure. integrated agency model, people say, well, that's much better because we can match the governance and ecosystem scale. We can adjust borders or zones over time if we've got one Uber agency doing all these decisions. It could reduce transaction costs. And it might make it harder for one interest group to exert power over decisions. Right? These are just potential benefits. And of course, there's also thinking about none of these actually could occur. It depends on how this system worked within it, this Uber agency. It's a coordinated agency model. People argue you've got to think about a system to resolve differences. It could be higher transaction costs with all these consultations and coordination. But at the same time, this is our current structure. Right? We deal with interagencies task force at the federal level or state level. And so there is a cost to thinking about, of course, changing to some other model, especially given that this is where we are. But these are just different ideas. Better match expertise, so specialized zone, better match expertise with the particular zone, better represent this idea of weaker interests in the process, that each then interest has a zone to manage and they manage it. They don't have to try to come to some agreement with other ones if they don't want to. Other thing to think about is sort of in the federalist ideals of the sort of natural experiments. You could have these specialized zones and all of them being managed slightly differently, giving us information on what the impacts are in the ecology from different gradations of management. Okay, so I think I'll speeding up, but I'll make it. So nice concept, but not necessary. Yes, I understand that, but you have to look around the world. Places like New Zealand, for example, which were leaders in thinking about catch share programs. They were in the 1980s, basically turning over a lot of their fisheries, understanding about the idea of better defining user rights. But what they left out were, they left out conservation and this idea of marine reserves, they left out aquaculture, and they left out recreational fishing. And currently, the level of conflicts in that system are actually almost to the point where they could potentially collapse the commercial, all the gains that were made in the commercial fishing side. So this idea of taking a broader perspective is quite important. Conflicts will not go away, yes. But I think it's naive to think that those conflicts don't exist today. They just exist in a regulatory process where you've got different groups exerting power via lobbying, rent-seeking going on. It's not like this doesn't exist. So the idea that you're making zoning, what you're doing is just taking that process and making it a much more transparent process, putting it up front and saying this is how it's going to work. Oceans different from terrestrial settings. Yeah, that's true, obviously, right? We can see trees and forests, but it's very hard to see under the water. But that's changing. With new development and technologies, we can monitor and enforce lines in water. We can understand where vessels are and activities they're doing in different parts of the water column, right? And so we can have a better sense of how to regulate these different activities. So lastly, I'll sort of leave with this idea of, is this compatible with climate change? And I'd argue that relative to our current system and the systems that are being promoted out there for marine spatial planning, that the answer is yes, that this is actually trying to understand how we could build a system that the users have flexibility, that you could permit groups to negotiate within and across and within other zones and across zones. And this idea that, you know, we're not going to address climate change in the oceans with regulation every single time, that's just a burdensome process. The users are in the water are going to have much more information about how things are changing and how it's going to impact. And so if we can create means for non-regulatory measures, I think that's important. The idea of dominant use, these ideas of long-term concessions, creates a durable system where you've got this now, this idea of an ownership ethic. People have a stake in it, so we can think about creating adaptation policies to avoid some of the potential negative effects that are coming down the line. You have incentives to invest in them. It's going to reward innovation. And the idea here is that they get a return now. They see this return. They could plan out in the future, and they can begin to innovate. They have conditions that are necessary for it. Climate change isn't going to make everything go away. Things are going to change. Ranges of species in the biological realm are going to shift. Right? That's going to create new opportunities in some places, or in all places. And the idea is I'd rather have a system in place that rewards that innovation to be able to take into account that and plan for it than we have to think about how to re-regulate things or move fishermen up the coast to catch particular fish. And then finally, as I mentioned throughout, I think this is a means of improving accountability in the system. So I study mass a lot, and I do equations. And so even though this is a public lecture, here's my equation. I've got components that I think are important. I think you have to have the features. And if we do this, we can get close to this goal of sustainable, wise use of ocean resources and vibrant coastal communities where we have the partnerships necessary to do so. And that's it.
Okay, I'm fully behind you with the need for ocean zoning and moving away from a tragedy of the commons type of situation. I'm a little worried about, I guess I don't have a lot of faith I'm worried about the dominant use and burden of proof. And the reason that I'm concerned is because there's big money and there's lobbyists that make things great even when they're black and white. So I was wondering what your comments were about that.
Okay, there's two ways to go about that. Well, first of all, thank you for actually buying into some of the story. But with respect to dominant use, yes, there's got to have to be accountability. There's going to have to be oversight. And so we have to think about, and I know there's very good ecologists out there, marine ecologists, trying to work on indicators, ways of sort of measuring what the potential indication of a health of a particular area or ecosystem. And so in that development, you can imagine the idea of these sort of ecological quality standards being sort of monitored as we do water quality standards, right? The idea that we'd be out there monitoring, we'd have the systems to do this. The fact that these powers exist, they exist now. So, and they already exert the power that you're talking about. The question is this going to make it any worse, or does it potentially give mechanisms for it to actually make it better, that they have a better idea of where their uses will occur. You've created that, narrowed that down. And so, you know, the potential for conflicts would be potentially reduced. I always go back when I go through these questions, and I am not an advocate for anything. I'm more of a policy analyst. I throw ideas out there, and then I criticize them, try to think about how it might work or not. But when I think about this idea is that I look what's out there. I look at the marine spatial plan as a map, the static map, and that's how we're just going to do this, and we're getting all these gains. And what I'm trying to think about is, and then also what the current situation is, and we know that that's not sustainable, right? There's things that are changing. We're trying to tweak it, and so this is trying to say is, can we create conditions that try to move us off of those static maps, move us off of the current condition in directions that are positive. In a lot of directions, economics, ecology, social, cultural. But every system's gonna have potential rent capture, and the question is this any worse than what the other proposals are?
Hi, Jim, I enjoy your talk greatly. You make things seem so simple when actually I think they're very complex. Like the Marine Life Protection Act that the scientists put forward 5 years ago, and you're still trying to resolve a temporal and zonal regions just in the North Coast, and that's not done yet. And that's just one issue. I mean, you've got a whole bunch of issues here that are political, scientific, moral, economic, and I respect people like you that go to these lakes and try to simplify things so that dumb guys like surfers can understand it.
So, it is... The allocation is a very difficult process. And I guess one thing to think about is there's an optimistic view is that Massachusetts, Rhode Island, California are all on the path of going to more comprehensive. But they started on let's just deal with one issue at a time, sort of incremental approach. And they're potentially getting there. I think, though, this process in California, it's really been about conservation, right? You read the Marine Life Protection Act, the goals of conservation. And what happened, what would have been the different framework if instead of just going in and saying we're going to create these areas, they actually decided that, at the same time we're going to do this, recreational fishermen, I know in this Southern California is so important, we're going to think about doing experiments, we're going to create areas that are for you guys at the same time. So we're going to change the allocation where it's not we're going to take things away from you, but we're also going to think about potentially giving you things, that there's a positive side to this whole experiment. And I think, there's some ideas, and it's simple, I know, but some ideas that might have been actually an easier process. then people were very sort of defensive, right? That I fish here, this is where I've been, or I recreate here and now I can't do it anymore, as opposed to trying to do it in a little bit more holistic where you can potentially kind of mitigate some of that opposition.
Well, say a word about the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary, because that's a wonderful success story, and they worked hard at that.
I might turn that back to you, actually. It was, well, I know, as you mentioned, Billy Cosley, right? That's his, was
Billy Cosley.
Cosley was, and he was actually burned in, I think, an effigy I saw. So it was not an easy process, but he was able to get through, I think, in building his sort of trust within the stakeholder community. And he was, from what I understand, also from that area.
He was from that area. He had done all of the things in a previous life that he was now trying to get people to give up. He was a treasure salver using these high-speed jet hoses. He was collecting ornamental fish and selling them. And he was selected to be the superintendent. And he really worked at this for years. He was hung in effigy. I was one of three people who was asked to come down to review the progress. It was early in the process, and we were out in a restaurant one night having dinner. We were getting ready to write our report, and we were in a booth with a high back, and these fishermen came up from the other booth behind us, and they looked at us and said, "You say one more word about marine protected areas, we're going to take you out in the alley." We moved our location in that restaurant. All right, who has another comment? All right. Yeah.
I make an assumption that throughout all of this, we would have a greater source of fish population, that the population would improve. Is there a limitation to this in terms, or do you see it where it's going to become stagnant? Or now you are regulating, there is a certain amount of regulation of fish, but are we saving a certain amount of fish so that therefore there'll be a greater number to be produced?
I think we are at such a point right now. Yes, of course, everything can increase out to infinity, right? The populations are regulated by the other populations, the predators and such. So, but we are at such a point where, and I'm not an ecologist, but I think they would all agree, that we are so low in terms of where we've driven these populations, that we are so far from where those population regulation mechanisms come into play, like, you know, limitations on habitat, limitations due to predators, et cetera, that there is so much room for improving the current conditions that I don't see that necessarily. And what you saw in catch share programs, a lot of them are implemented after years of open access or regulated access where those populations were really at, 15-20% of their maximum. And in some of them where they actually said, you know what, we're going to cut what you can catch. We're going to allocate you a share, but then we're cutting what the total is. In the work I've looked at in New Zealand, we've actually found that those fisheries, the profitability of those fisheries increased at a faster rate than those fisheries that weren't facing the cuts. And there's ecological reasons just in terms of the populations rebounding, but there was economic reasons. So there's the idea here that we know that we can have higher populations and things will be more profitable, but we can't get there without dealing with the rights issues and how to define them better from what they currently are. And that's what catch shares, and that's what hopefully dominant use ideas would get us there.
And while the experience with catch shares is still limited, there are really good successes, not just New Zealand, but in Iceland and in other areas around the world. Stocks have come back. How about a big round of applause for you?
Thank you very much.